Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
This is Dave Cornelison again. This is Season 1, Show 1, and a webcast version of STEM Spots produced by Missouri State University's Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science in conjunction with KSMU. If you've already listened to the radio version of this broadcast, you know that the guest with me in the studio today is Dr. Peter Plofchin from the Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science. Hi, Peter.
It's great to be back, Dave.
So we already talked a little bit about extrasolar planets, and of course for this webcast version, we're going to go into much greater depth and detail for people who want to learn a little bit more about extrasolar planets and their relation to us and our lives. So Peter, we started off talking a little bit about what extrasolar planets were, and of course you had about, 25 seconds to go over that. So could you talk a little bit more at length about extrasolar planets, what they are, what kinds are there, and so forth and so on?
Well, it's fair to say that there are more kinds of exoplanets than we have planets in our solar system. So the planets in our solar system fall into two categories. We call them terrestrial planets, the rocky planets like Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. And then we have the Jovian planets in our solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. They're mostly gassy and they have large gaseous atmospheres. Outside our solar system, we found something unlike anything we'd ever seen before. And these were gassy planets like Jupiter and Saturn, but located closer to their stars than Mercury is to our own sun. So we call those hot Jupiters. We have no idea how they got there. We have some theories, but we're working on that right now, is understanding where those hot Jupiters come from. We also have possible planets that might be water worlds, where their surface is covered entirely in water. We have planets that are bigger than Neptune, so we call those super Neptunes. And we do have Jovian planets like Jupiter. We have planets that are probably Earth-like, and more to be discovered.
So presumably there is some sort of a model that would govern the formation of these solar systems, and our particular solar system is just one specific outcome of a wide range of possibilities then.
That's right. These hot Jupiters, as it turns out, are fairly rare. About one in every 100 stars has a hot Jupiter, but they were the easiest ones to find, so they perplexed us early on. In terms of models for planet formation, they are generally two competing theories. One is called the core accretion theory of planet formation, and the other one is called the gravitational instability model of planet formation. Core accretion is very good at making the terrestrial planets, but it's very difficult in predicting how long it takes to form the Jovian planets. Gravitational instability is very good at making the Jovian planets, but not so good at making the terrestrial planets. So probably in reality, planet formation is a combination of both processes in nature.
Would that mean that the Jovian-type planets would form farther away and get migrated in towards their sun? Is that likely, or is it likely that they form close?
That's right. So we know that the Jovian planets, the hot Jupiters, they had to form further out, right around where the distance Jupiter is today. And that's because out at that distance, water in our early solar system existed in a frozen state as opposed to a gaseous state. And so, in other words, ice, right? So we have lots of solid material out past the orbit of Jupiter, out past the orbit of Mars, with which to make these very big planets. When compared to very close into our sun, the terrestrial planets, water there is in a liquid state. So there's not as much solid material, the building blocks to make planets. So it is thought that Jovian planets formed farther out, then something caused them to go in closer to their stars. And once again, there's several different theories for how those hot Jupiters got to where they are today.
And you say that you got confused at the beginning, as in a general rule, because you saw so many of these hot Jupiters, and that's because of the bias in your experimental detection.
That's right. As it turns out, bigger planets are easier to find. The smaller planets, they produce smaller signals, so they're harder to detect.
And so let's go over again the three different detection methods you might use. One might be a wobble method that you would actually pick up in two different ways. Can
right.
you talk about
so
those?
So the wobble method is also known as the radial velocity method. So planet doesn't technically orbit a star. It orbits the center of mass of the system, of the stellar system. So just as like a planet's going around that center, the star actually orbits around the center of mass. Since more than 99% of the mass of the star is, more than 99% of the mass of the solar system is in the star, the center mass of the stellar system is very close to the star. So the star doesn't move very much. But when you have roughly an Earth-sized planet orbiting a sun-like star at the same distance our Earth does, that'll cause the sun to move back and forth at a velocity of around 10 centimeters per second.
10 centimeters per second.
10 centimeters per second.
And you're going to pick up 10 centimeters per second from the Earth.
Well, the technology isn't quite there yet today. In fact, the lowest velocity planet that we've been able to detect is around 50 centimeters per second, about five times that value. And that was for an Earth mass planet orbiting Alpha Centauri B, the nearest star system to the Earth. So the technology is slowly getting there, but we are talking about detecting stars moving back and forth at no faster than running speeds.
And so you would detect that by looking for the Doppler shift in one way, or you could conceivably look for the actual position of the star, which is more commonly used.
So more commonly today, we use the Doppler shift. So that's right. When the star is coming towards us, the light from the star is slightly bluer. And when the star is moving away from us, the light from the star is slightly redder. And so we use spectrographs to take spectrum of these stars at very high resolution, separating out the light into many different colors. And so we look with those techniques, we're able to see the light from the star go bluer, then redder, then bluer, then redder. And so if we see that pattern repeating with time, we know something's tugging on that star. And by how much the color's changing and how fast it's changing, we can figure out the mass of the planet and its orbit. Now, you mentioned another way to use the motion of the star to find planets, and that method's called astrometry, where you're measuring the position of the star very precisely. Now, unfortunately, to date, we haven't been able to do that from the ground with enough precision in order to detect planets. We can find other stars orbiting other stars that way, but it's really going to take a space mission in order to get astrometry to work right, in order to have sufficient accuracy and precision. But with the radial velocity method working so well, we're just not going to be pursuing that anytime soon.
So let me ask you this. What if you indeed have a multiple planet solar system, which probably is relatively common? Then, of course, this tugging is going to be more complex. So how are you going to tease out what specific planets might be moving in that particular context?
You've hit a hot button issue today, as we've learned. There are more and more multi-planet systems out there. In fact, while hot Jupiters were unique, when we find a hot Jupiter, usually it's one of only one or two planets in its system. The smaller planets tend to come in bunches. So we might find a star that has three or four or six planets in some recent cases. And teasing out all those individual signals is a challenge. And only way we can tackle it today is by taking many observations of the star and then building models of the orbits of each of the individual planets and then fitting that to the movement of the star.
So would you be involved in doing observation primarily or modeling, or are you guys at your Missouri State group doing both?
So we do a little bit of both. I mean, I recently published a paper where we were doing modeling in the Astrophysical Journal of the Alpha Centauri B planet. But I also do observations. So we are building spectrographs to measure the Doppler velocities of stars ourselves. So we do a little bit of both, and I think that has its advantages because you're not relying on another team or another group to, say, build the instruments for you or to take the data for you.
So usually you think about research astronomy being done at large astronomical observatories in the West, but you're trying to do some work additionally out at Baker Observatory outside Marshfield, which belongs to MSU. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as it turns out, it's true. The bigger research universities have the bigger telescopes and more resources than we might hear at Baker Observatory. But with the Doppler method, I came to the realization that rather than having one big telescope, we can get away with a lot of smaller telescopes. And the reason for that is telescopes give us two general properties that depend on their size: how much light they gather and how closely spaced they can tell two different stars apart from one another. And that's called angular resolution. So bigger telescopes collect more light and they have better angular resolution. But as it turns out, in most cases, for the Doppler method, we don't care about the angular resolution. We just care about how much light we're gathering. So it oftentimes can be cheaper by using lots of little telescopes rather than one big telescope.
And so out at Baker Observatory, are you going to have students trying to do some of these observations?
That's right. As I mentioned on the online and the radio broadcast, we are working right now on roboticizing small telescopes to automate the process of observing stars in the sky and taking data. Because if you're going to have 10 of these telescopes, you're going to need a computer to take these observations for you, rather than having 10 people sitting at each telescope individually collecting the data.
So over the next, how many years will you be pursuing this project?
Well, we're just getting started. As you know, I'm a new professor here, been here for about a year. And so we're working with the first telescope right now. It's a smaller telescope. And so we're still eking out all the little differences to get the telescope to point where we want it to stay on a star when we want it to. Our first camera just arrived to take digital images of the sky. And so we're working on the programs to read out that camera, to save the data, to figure out where the star is on that digital camera, to move the telescope to where the star needs to be. And so it's going to take some time. So I imagine it'll be a couple of years before we're operational with more than one telescope.
And then to get funds for this kind of research, do you go to granting agencies primarily? What exactly are you doing with that?
So these days, it's very difficult to get funding. Funding for NASA and NSF isn't what it used to be, especially with more faculty members in lots of universities. But we submit grant applications to NASA and NSF and occasionally look for private donations as well. But in our case, I've been submitting proposals to both NASA and NSF to fund the purchase of some bigger telescopes than the ones we're using right now, and generally to fund students to do their work and to get the resources we need, the cameras, the equipment, the computers, the lenses, the mirrors, et cetera, to build these observatories.
Right. And so are you also looking for funds that might come from the public, general public in some way, shape, or form?
Certainly. I guess I have to discuss that with my dean at some point.
Yeah, we're also interested in that. As the department head in our department, we're looking for ways to involve the public in looking to improve Baker Observatory. Certainly improving the astronomical observation capabilities out there would be one thing we would be interested in doing.
Yeah, let me say one thing about that. I mean, the telescopes we have at Baker, I mean, they're showing their age. We've had them for maybe 25-plus years now. And some of them were basically hand-me-down telescopes from an observatory in Chile, for example. So the telescopes themselves are actually much older, 40, 50 years in some cases. And things have really changed. Technology's changed over the past 20 years. We all know that. We all have digital smartphones and cameras on our smartphones, GPS. And so there's some new companies out there that are making telescopes that are much more advanced than the ones we have at reasonable costs. So that's what we're looking at doing.
One of the things we hope the public will do is get out to some of the public nights. Can you talk about those a little bit?
That's right. So at Baker Observatory, we have open houses once a semester. That's sponsored by NASA through a consortium called Space Grant. And we have all our telescopes on display. You can come look through them, and we'll look at things like the planets, like Venus and Jupiter and Saturn, if they're visible, as well as the moon and stars in clusters, binary stars, nebula, and things like that.
Speak for a moment about how astronomy seems to get into the interest of the general public.
Well, as I said on the radio broadcast, we've been wondering about what's up there ever since we could wonder. The question of are we alone, we can easily trace it back to beyond the ancient Greeks over 2,000 years ago. And I think the public's excited to know that we're finally answering that question. You might have heard on the news just a couple of days ago, a NASA scientist saying in 20, 30 years, we might know whether or not there is other life in the solar system, or is the Earth unique?
Sometimes people want too much. Would you say that that's true? When the NASA scientist says life on another planet, that might invoke some old little green men, but in fact, it's probably going to mean something quite different than that.
Right. So there's a question of whether there's intelligent life out there, and that's something that SETI looks at. And there was actually a recent news article on CNN about that. One of my colleagues, Jason Wright, looked at the possibility that there might be advanced civilizations in other galaxies. And long story short, he didn't find any among the nearest 100,000 galaxies. But when you have 100 billion galaxies in our universe, we've still got a long way to go. On the flip side of that, you know, we know life started on the Earth as a primordial life, bacteria, single-celled organisms. And so maybe those are easier to get started in our universe, and we don't know the answer to that. But certainly, when we have life on a planet, it produces certain types of gases in the atmosphere of that planet. And so we're thinking about missions today to look for these so-called biomarkers around other planets where we can actually see the signature of, for example, the greenhouse gases or in particular, chlorophyll, for example, in the atmosphere of another planet.
Very interesting. So if anybody wanted to come and talk to you about astronomy as a major, what would you tell them?
Well, I'd definitely encourage it. There's definitely a lot of career opportunities that can come with getting a major or even a minor in astronomy if you're majoring in physics, for example. I personally was a physics major as an undergrad, and it's people value having the problem-solving skills that you gain from an astronomy major or a physics major. And it's applicable to a lot of different fields. So I definitely encourage you to come talk to me. We certainly have research opportunities for you to get involved in looking at the data we're taking with these telescopes.
Well, thanks very much, Peter, for coming by and talking for a few minutes. And for everybody out there in Radio Land, this is StemSpot's first webcast, Show 1, Year 1. And please continue to listen, as each week we'll bring topics from different areas of science and how they might pertain to your life. Thanks very much. This is Dave Cornelison.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.